their motor vehicles. Once parties have just departed, other parties please step up and get situated. Ready to proceed.
Good morning. I'm Melanie Kochka, and I'm here representing the appellant, Kara O'Keefe, and I too would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The standard a hearing officer uses to review an appointing authority's disciplinary decision is a de novo standard. NRS 284.390 subsection 1 provides that the hearing officer determines the reasonableness of a permanent classified employee's dismissal. If the hearing officer determines that the dismissal was without just cause as provided in NRS 284.385, the action must be set aside and the employee must be reinstated with full pay for the period of dismissal. The statute, subsection 6, provides that the decision of the hearing officer is binding on the parties. NAC 284.798 specifically provides that the hearing officer's standard of review of DMV's disciplinary decision is non-deferential. It states, the hearing officer shall make no assumptions of innocence or guilt, but shall be guided in his or her decision by the weight of the evidence as it appears to him or her at the hearing. That is the essence of de novo, or non-deferential standard of review. Kara O'Keefe was charged with having violated a policy that the state DMV argues is non-discretionary and required termination. However, that is not true. The policy itself refers to the use or manipulation of production data, and it specifically ties it into and may be subject to prosecution under NRS 205.481. That particular statute's a criminal statute, and it provides for prosecution under the crime of forgery, and specifically defines the crime as someone who willfully creates, alters, or deletes any data. Now, Ms. O'Keefe did not manipulate or disclose any data. She accessed...
We're not under the criminal statute or the criminal authority. We're under the civil authority in this particular case.
Yes.
And I guess the concern I have is that the hearing officer did find a violation, but yet just kind of brushed it aside. Why should we take a deep look at this?
Okay. The hearing officer found a violation of policy, but she also found that the reliable, substantial, and probative evidence indicated an inconsistency between the policy, the prohibition and penalty G1, and the memorandum that was sent out regarding this offense from then DMV Director Bruce Breslow. The memorandum provided for appropriate disciplinary action, suggesting that the level of discipline for this offense is discretionary. If it's a discretionary offense, it's within the purview of the hearing officer to decide whether termination is appropriate, whether it met the just cause standard of for the good of the public service. And the hearing officer not only considered that, but she also considered the fact that Ms. O'Keefe was a seven-year DMV employee. She fabulously handled her accounts in the motor carrier division. She had not been provided progressive discipline. She had received exceed standards evaluations. And because of all of that, because of DMV's failure to promptly investigate this matter and take immediate corrective action, the hearing officer decided that dismissal was too severe. It was just too severe a form of discipline, and she recommended a 30-day suspension. And the reason it's important that you consider it is because the district court and the Court of Appeals both assumed that this disciplinary standard or policy was a no-tolerance policy, that, in other words, you commit an infraction, you're terminated automatically. And that just wasn't true. That isn't what she found, what the hearing officer found. There were two witnesses at the hearing from DMV, an Alice Doble and a Wayne Seidel, and they both testified that a violation of this policy subjected an employee to discretionary discipline, not automatic termination.
Wait a second. There's an indication that she had signed a memo from the DMV director warning that querying records for purposes other than DMV business is strictly forbidden, and the first offense can result in termination. Doesn't that give pretty significant
notice? It does
say
it can result. It doesn't say it will result. And it goes on, and in that same memo it says appropriate disciplinary action will be taken. And that appropriate disciplinary action means it's discretionary. It means that you look at the facts.
But they consider it a significant offense, and as I'm sure you're aware, unauthorized access to certain databases can result in that body losing its ability to access going forward. And so that's why it's significant, NCI criminal databases that aren't available to the public, for instance, have certain authorized users.
I don't know whether those criminal databases are accessible by, or were accessible by Ms. O'Keefe. She had access to the DMV databases, and that's what, and she did access
it. Confidential databases?
Yes, but she did not manipulate any data. She didn't disclose the data to anyone. She didn't alter or delete any data. And that's what that policy, the G1 policy, seems to go to, are those more severe kinds of offenses.
Excuse me, ma'am?
Yes.
So is it your position that the agency's determination, because here the hearing officer agreed with every single finding of the agency, but the final determination about what should be the proper discipline, is it your position that that agency determination is entitled to no deference at all?
Yes, it is my position, and I say that because the legislature created the hearing officers to make those determinations and gave state employees the statutory right to appeal the decision, basically, of their agency to the hearing officer. And then it's the hearing officer's job to weigh the evidence and decide whether discipline is appropriate. And you have to remember that in this case, the conduct had occurred in 2012, and in December 2012, Ms. O'Keefe left the agency and went to work for a different state agency. And they decided, DMV decided at that point in time, that it was not going to investigate the conduct at all because she had left the agency. And it was only when she wanted to exercise her right under the regulations to return to DMV that DMV decided 9 months later that they had to investigate these allegations. But they didn't do it at the time, and that greatly bothered the hearing officer and should have bothered the hearing officer.
What was the prejudice from that delay?
The prejudice from the delay was the lack of witnesses. She didn't have access to the sheriff's office's telephone recordings to show what she had really said in trying to help this family friend. It impeded her defense because she didn't, I mean, it impedes memory of events when a long period of time goes by. So arguably, there would have been other witnesses. There would have been these recordings of the sheriff's office. And just as a matter of fact, or a matter of law, she had the right to reinstatement to her job. The regulation gave her that right.
Doesn't NRS 284.385 subsection 1 authorize dismissal so long as the appointing authority considers that the good of the public service will be served thereby? Yes. So doesn't that contemplate that review would be from the perspective of the appointing authority's consideration of what constitutes the public good?
No, because it's exactly the same criteria that the hearing officer has to use. The hearing officer has to apply the same standard in 385, that subsection, and has to determine whether the termination or the discipline meets the good of the public service. So it's the state legislature that has set up this system, and it's a typical civil service commission system. By giving the employer first makes the determination, I'll just finish my thought real fast. The employer first makes the determination, but then it's up to the hearing officer to decide basically whether they agree. And no deference is owed under the regulations. It's like a completely new hearing. They consider the evidence, they consider the witnesses, and more importantly, they consider progressive discipline, of which she had none, and they consider the good of the public service.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Jordan Smith on behalf of the Nevada Department of Motor Vehicles. Although there is a conflict in this court's case law between Knapp on the one hand, Dredge somewhat in the middle, and Lipinski on the other hand, this case is one of statutory interpretation. In NRS Chapter 284, the legislature struck a balance between the rights of state employees and the responsibility and obligations of the executive branch to control and operate its agencies. Because of that balance, hearing officers do not have the statutory authority to second-guess the employment decisions of the executive branch. And hearing officers are precluded from setting aside disciplinary actions that are consistent with the policies adopted by the appointing authorities and approved by the Personnel Commission. And I'll address the issues in that order.
Mr. Smith, I was going to ask, how do you view the progressive discipline issue in this case with her evaluations being exemplary, and then the fact that there's been no progressive discipline at all in this case. How does that fit with your interpretation of the absolute right of termination?
Certainly. So progressive discipline isn't universal. Under NRS 284.383 subsection 1, progressive discipline is unnecessary in cases of a serious violation. Even under the administrative regulations, NAC 284.638 regarding written reprimands, and then 642 regarding suspension, and of course 646 with discipline. Lower levels of discipline can be skipped if misconduct is deemed serious. So in this case, the G1 offense, if you look at the prohibitions and penalties, dismissal was the only available disciplinary action in that case. So in this case, once the hearing officer determined that there was substantial evidence that the misconduct occurred, and the dismissal fell within the range appropriate, the range given in the prohibitions and penalties, that was the end of the analysis for Ms. O'Keefe's case. It may be trickier in other cases where misconduct falls within a range, and there's a possible range aside from only dismissal, because in this case, dismissal was the only available disciplinary action or the G1 violation. Other ones have a range of 2 to 5, 1 to 5. But even in that case, a hearing officer is limited to determining whether there is substantial evidence, one, that misconduct occurred, and then two, whether there is substantial evidence that from which the appointing authority can consider the misconduct serious enough that lower levels of discipline are not necessary. So it's still a substantial evidence analysis. It's just there's just two layers to it. One, that the misconduct actually occurred, and two, that this was serious enough that lower levels of discipline were not necessary. So in case of progressive discipline, it's still a substantial evidence analysis.
So are you saying that because G1 violations were deemed to be serious by the agency, once you have substantial evidence supporting a finding of a G1 violation, that's the end of the hearing officer's review?
Yes, in Ms. O'Keefe's case, that's correct. Because that's the only one available, the two inquiries kind of overlap each other. Other cases where there's a range of potential disciplinary measures, the analysis might get trickier. But again, it's still a substantial evidence analysis that the misconduct occurred and that the violation was serious enough that from the appointing authority's standpoint, lower levels of discipline were unnecessary. And again, that stems from, as Justice Stiglitz was pointing out, stems from 284.385 subsection 1, where it says the appointing authority considers the good of the public service will be served thereby. My colleague's interpretation completely reads out of the statute the phrase, when the appointing authority considers. According to a de novo standard of review, it would be the hearing officer making that determination, which this court said in the Taylor decision is inappropriate. Hearing officers are not appointing authorities, and Taylor holds that hearing officers cannot exercise the powers of appointing authorities. And that's essentially what a de novo standard of review would allow. But really, so the fact that substantial evidence is a standard of review is confirmed by really two parts of NRS 284.390. One, subsection one says hearing officers determine the reasonableness of the action. And then subsection, it's now seven, it was subsection six when this litigation began, but it's now seven. It says that if a hearing officer determines that the dismissal, the motion or suspension is without just cause, as provided in NRS 284.385. So the question really is, does the word reasonableness and does the phrase just cause support a substantial evidence type of review? And the answer is yes. This court held in the Surrey versus Chiropractic Board that substantial evidence language most often conveys a reasonableness standard of review. So reasonableness and substantial evidence are really two sides of the same coin. The federal courts have said that substantial evidence is really a quantification of the reasonableness standard. And just cause is very similar. This court held in Southwest Gas versus Vargas that just cause is a cause that is, one, supported by substantial evidence, and two, reasonably believed by the employer to be true. So just cause also contains a substantial evidence component and a reasonableness component. So when you apply those interpretations of reasonableness and just cause to the statutory scheme, the analysis kind of goes like this. You look at NRS 284.390 subsection 7, which says that if a hearing officer determines the dismissal is without just cause, i.e. without substantial evidence, as provided in NRS 284.385, then you look at 385, which says it's the appointing authority who makes the initial determination of whether the disciplinary action will serve the good of the public service, then you're left with hearing officers reviewing the appointing authority's decision for substantial evidence. And that's the same framework this court used in Lipinski. In Lipinski, this court held that the determinative issue before the city council is whether substantial evidence was placed before the city council from which it could make a finding that legal cause existed. That's the same analytical process used here. The court's statement in Knapp to the contrary are misplaced. Knapp didn't analyze the statutory framework. Knapp didn't engage in a textualist analysis of what the statute actually says. It didn't grapple with what does reasonableness mean or what does just cause mean. Without citation, Knapp simply said, generally hearing officers do not defer to the decisions of appointing authorities. The Knapp decision references Justice Springer's dissent, but respectfully, Justice Springer didn't cite any authority for his statement either. Instead, Knapp turns primarily on the administrative code, NAC 284.798, which says that hearing officers shall not make any assumptions of guilt or innocence, but shall be guided by their view of the evidence. But to the extent that administrative provision is read as allowing de novo review, it conflicts with the plain language of 284.385. Hearing officers, again, do not conduct a de novo review. It is only the appointing authorities who determine whether the good of the public service will be served thereby. My colleague says that a substantial evidence review conducted by a hearing officer conflates what courts do under 233B.135, but they're two separate analyses, albeit they're similar, but they are different, and it's the same framework that is currently employed under Dredge right now. Under Dredge, hearing officers conduct a deferential review to the appointing authority's decisions, and then courts conduct an abuse of discretion review of the hearing officer's determinations. And that's what the statute requires for all appointing authorities, not just appointing authorities that deal with security programs. So it's really what I sort of characterize it as a system of double deference. One, hearing officers defer to the appointing authority's decisions, and then courts under 233B.135 then review the hearing officer's determination under an abuse of discretion review. So there are sort of two layers of deference there. That's not unheard of. For example, that happens most often in federal habeas cases where the federal courts defer to the state court's decisions and the state court's deferring in, for example, ineffective assistance of counsel claims to counsel's performance. So the statutes require that all appointing authorities be given deference, not just appointing authorities dealing with security programs. Perhaps under NAC 284.650 subsection 3, security programs are entitled to an extra measure of deference, but under the statute 284.385 doesn't distinguish between types of appointing authorities. All appointing authorities get reviewed for reasonableness and get reviewed for just cause.
So are you proposing that we modify NAP to eliminate the reference to the dissent by Justice Springer and Dredge?
Yes, that's one aspect of it, and I would also ask the court to modify the statement at the beginning of that paragraph that says, generally, hearing officers do not defer to the appointing authority's decisions. I don't think that statement can be squared with what 284.385 and 390 actually say.
And this case is a good candidate for that in your view, because why? I'm a little concerned whether this case is a good vehicle for this because of the G1 declaration that preexisted the termination. Even crediting your position, it seems to me that you walk through that, and once you have substantial evidence to support the G1 violation, you have arguably an agency determination that fits under the statute.
This is a good vehicle for two reasons. One, if you look at the hearing officer's decision, specifically, I think it's at 46 and 47 of the respondent's appendix, the hearing officer says she was conducting a, quote, independent determination of whether the good of the public service would be served by the action. That statement alone is incorrect. The hearing officer should have been reviewing for substantial evidence. So the issue is squarely presented because the hearing officer said, that she was engaging in an independent determination of whether the good of the public service would be served by the termination. That conflicts with the statute. On the second point with regard to G1, this issue is even more squarely presented, I think, because she said that notwithstanding the fact that the policy said this is a terminable offense, notwithstanding the fact that by administrative code this is a terminable offense, I still find this in my own independent judgment. She didn't say independent judgment, but she determined it not serious. So it had been deemed serious by the policy, it had been deemed serious by administrative code. She gave no deference to that, and she simply just said, I don't think this is serious. A 30-day suspension is more appropriate.
Can you prevail in your position under NAP, though? To prevail, to win, do you have to have us overrule or reject that paragraph in NAP?
Yes, because if you let that paragraph stand, which the hearing officer cited in her decision, the hearing officer would be empowered to say, independently, I find that this is not a serious offense. But notwithstanding that the appointing authority had before it evidence that this was a serious offense, that she did access the computer database 10 times, notwithstanding that there was evidence before the appointing authority from which it could determine this was a serious offense, I find this not to be serious.
Mr. Smith, I'm sorry, just...
I had one follow-up, if I might.
I'm sorry.
So stare decisis teaches that we adhere to existing decisions unless they're utterly unworkable and the law is a mess. I'm not quite stating this correctly, but how is it that that's true of the NAP Dredge distinction? Because Dredge is the security issue, which is a little different than the NAP issue.
Right. Two points on stare decisis, perhaps three. The Dredge analysis should apply to all decisions by hearing officers, not just security programs. And so there is confusion amongst hearing officers about what their standard of review is. I mean, that was at issue in Constantino, and it hasn't gotten better since Constantino.
Okay.
So there is some uncertainty amongst hearing officers what standard of review they should be using. So stare decisis counsels for clarifying that. When a court's precedent so squarely conflicts with what the plain language of the statute says, as it does here, I don't think there's any effect of stare decisis by keeping NAP on the books when its statement that there's no deference to appointing authorities just can't be reconciled with the statutory language. And also from a stare decisis standpoint, I think there's an argument to be made that Knapp actually is a step outside of this court's precedence. Earlier cases, the Welliver decision, Oliver versus Spitz, for example, talk about legal cause and what that means. And so to the extent that there's case law that predates Knapp, Knapp is actually sort of a step outside of that as well. But I don't think Knapp, given the fact that it's so squarely in conflict with the statutory scheme, I don't think Knapp is entitled to any sort of stare decisis effect.
Mr. Smith, isn't Knapp, I'm sorry, can you done?
I am,
okay.
Thank you.
Isn't Knapp factually distinguishable in any event? Because in Knapp, the hearing officer found there was insufficient evidence of the most serious violation. Here, the hearing officer found there was sufficient evidence of the most serious violation. I mean, is it factually distinguishable in any event?
That's correct. In Knapp, the hearing officer found that the appointing authority in that case only proved two offenses, and dismissal was not available for any of those two offenses. And I think the appointing authority actually conceded that fact during the district court proceedings. So there's no concession here that that's the case, and the terminable offenses were proven. So Knapp is factually distinguishable, and the DMV could prevail on those grounds. But that would still leave the uncertainty about what standard of review the hearing officer should apply. And that issue will still confound hearing officers and eventually still work its way up to this court if the court doesn't clarify that in this case. And I do think this is, given the way the hearing officer conducted her analysis by saying, I'm engaging in an independent determination of whether I think the good of the public service will be served, I do think this is a good vehicle to resolve that issue. Unless the court has any further questions.
Additional?
Thank you for your time.
Ms. Kotchka, as you approach the podium, would you talk about the G1 determination and automatic termination?
Excuse me?
The G1? The termination and then automatic termination with that.
Yes.
Where we don't look at evaluations or progressive discipline. I mean, that's what Mr. Smith argued.
Okay. I believe Mr. Smith is wrong in footnote 7 of his supplemental answering brief. He conceded that even if the discipline imposed is discretionary under G1, he argues the discretion belongs to the appointing authority, not the hearing officer, but that's simply not true. The hearing officer found that that the discipline for that policy is discretionary. It was discretionary because of the testimony of two witnesses and because of that memorandum that said it was discretionary. So therefore, it's not mandatory. The entire premise of this case just isn't factually correct. The hearing officer found that factually, the penalty is not mandatory discipline, it's discretionary discipline. And then that brings us back to the entire argument about the stare decisis and how everything should be considered under Dredge. But you can't. That flies in the face of the statutory scheme. NAC 284.650 subsection 3 provides deference if to the judgment of the appointing authority if the appointing authority is an institution administering its security program. That's the very basis of the difference between Knapp and Dredge. In Dredge, they did have to give deference to the appointing authority. And Knapp, they did not. And not one statute has been changed since Knapp. Knapp has been in existence since, I believe, it's 1995. It's never been changed by the legislature, which when you interpret legislative desires and wishes, usually the courts say, look, if they've never had any problem with our interpretation of the statutes, then we're doing it right. Because otherwise somebody would, you know, propose a bill to change it. And it's never been changed. And these regulations that were applied in this case and the statutes that were applied in this case are the same as they were in Knapp. And I disagree and think that Knapp, that the factual situations are similar, because what the hearing officer is talking about is discretionary discipline. It's the same thing as in Knapp, the degree of discipline. DMV decided to terminate. The hearing officer said the conduct isn't bad enough for termination given all these other facts. She concluded O'Keefe's conduct was not a serious violation of law or regulation, to merit termination prior to imposition of less severe disciplinary measures. She cited NRS 284.383 subsection 1. She said there was no written policy that said DMV could not pursue discipline on a DMV employee who no longer worked for them. She said it seemed disingenuous that the DMV considered this a serious offense on the one hand, but did not initiate disciplinary action until nearly 9 months after it learned of the alleged violations and after the employee was scheduled to return to work at the DMV. She said DMV did not provide any specific evidence to corroborate their assertion that O'Keefe's termination was commensurate with disciplinary action imposed on 5 other DMV employees involved in similar incidents. Both parties testified about an incident that occurred prior to 2011 where an employee accessed DMV information regarding the girlfriend. She used it to stalk the ex-husband and the girlfriend, and that employee only received a suspension. So she was very, very, very troubled by the sequence of events and the lack of taking prompt and corrective action. And her definition of serious, she addressed the serious, and she found that it couldn't have been as serious as they contended it was, or otherwise they would have taken immediate action. And I will remind the court the context in which this case arose. Could I finish? Thank you. Was it clearly arose under NAC 284.462-2. If O'Keefe had never wanted to come back to her job, which she was entitled to by regulation, there would have been no investigation, there would have been no termination. And so therefore, it's abundantly clear on this record that the discipline was taken in order to deprive her of a right that she had pursuant to a Nevada regulation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Koshka, Mr. Smith. Thank you for your arguments this day. This matter will